service in journalism and cultural expression.
Well, good morning. Welcome to the Sustainable Living Program with John Butts. John is here. He switches places with Eve Prang Plews. Eve will be back next week as we still have phone problems, but I think they may be working, so we might be able to do a call-in show today. That was the plan. So, John, how are you?
Oh, real good, Rob. How have you been? How was your weekend?
It was beautiful. I spent most of it outdoors. It was terrific. Yeah, beautiful weekend.
It's warming up.
And yeah, it's actually getting hot out there, isn't it?
I know.
It?
It's springtime. I turned on the fan last night.
Yeah.
All those ACs are cranking up. Well, like Rob says, we have a pledge drive, and it's going to restart here at 2 o'clock. And, of course, hey, at any time anybody wants to hit that tip jar, it's right there, just WMNF.org, and we'll gladly really appreciate any help we can get.
And, John, I noticed that Paul Nelson from Tampa just donated $25. He's a big fan of Indy FM, which is on Thursday nights here at WMNF. So John made a nice contribution via the tip jar. You can go to our tip jar. It's located at WMNF.org. And we had to shut down the marathon last Friday morning because our phones suddenly stopped working and we lost a major piece of equipment. We're reinstalling a new version of that equipment now. And hopefully all the phones will be working by 2 o'clock this afternoon when we restart the drive. I noticed, though, that we tried the phones a moment ago, and you can call in at 813-239-9663.
Uh-huh. And we're going to have a gardening show today. But what's up at 11, Rob?
Well, we're going to talk about, over the weekend, Israel and Iran had a clash. And there's fighting going on, aerial fighting going on between Iran and Israel. And that is a really big pressure point for the world. And so we're going to talk about that. And also we'll hear Florida this week.
Cool. Well, we'll keep tuned in. And, of course, Sean's going to be here at 12 o'clock. And I guess after that, pretty soon, I guess after executive session, we'll be starting our fun drive again, right?
Right.
Okay,
right.
Great. And as I said, we're going to have a gardening show today. At Friday, I thought I was going to be in here raising money. So I kind of thought, oh, gee whiz. And I sent Rob an email and... anyhow, I tried a couple of guests, and of course, one of my favorite guests on a gardening show has always been my brother, Carl Butts, and he's a farmer, also in Plant City. We started farming in, I guess it was 1989 or 1990. He had graduated from the University of Florida and went to Clemson, all in vegetable crop science, and he ended up in, Louisiana, LSU, I think, and Carl almost got his PhD. He had a couple of problems, but anyhow, he came back and he was our vegetable crop extension agent here in Hillsborough County. Carl, you there? You listening in?
Yeah, I'm hearing you.
Well, thanks so much for taking a little time out of your morning. You've been working, right?
Right. We're still harvesting greens, even though the weather isn't greens weather anymore. We have really a year round operation, but of course this time of the year we're picking our five items, I guess, five or six items in the cool season, and we're cutting our spinach and chard today. We have the green chard and the rainbow chard.
Okay. Carl, let me go ahead and introduce my other guests here, and she's another person that, I really look to Carl and my wife, Debbie. Debbie's here. Debbie, say hi.
Hi.
And they're kind of like the brains of the operation. Somehow I kind of didn't get... you know, like a lot of that intellectual stuff. But it's certainly, I've been very lucky as a farmer to have these great resources. And also, I got my grandsons here. Say hi, CJ.
Hello, everybody.
Yeah, hello, everybody. And CJ kind of helps us pick strawberries. And he's going to kind of start off with telling us about the three different kinds of strawberries when you're picking them. Can you tell our listeners about those?
The three different types of strawberries are the good strawberries, the very rotten strawberries that you throw out, and the kind of rotten, like not as like good for customers. We eat them,
okay.
And those are the three different types.
Okay, thank you, CJ. Okay, Carl, maybe, you know, it's a gardening program, and we hope people can call in or send us an email at WMNF.org and or DJ at WMNF.org. But maybe, you know, okay, you're growing some greens, some Swiss chard, and, you know, people out there with their home gardens can be growing the same exact things, and maybe some of the problems that you've had with these greens and some of the, you know, your solutions.
Right. Well, you know, it takes a long time, I guess, to figure out how to produce these things reliably. You know, you have to have a constant supply or you lose your buyers, right? And like I say, we attempt, you know, to grow things year-round. And so that means we're always at the various stages of seeding trays. You know, we do everything from transplants, and then we, you know, grow them in the greenhouse, transplant them to the field. And we do, you know, not large plantings. Everything is marketed locally, so you can't have, you know, 100 boxes or something because you can't sell them. In the local market, you have to kind of, you know, gauge your planting and harvesting to, you know, what you can move. I mean, these are all highly perishable products, and so you have to work in concert and sync with, you know, your market conditions. Anyway, there's. You know, the chard is a fairly hardy. You know, it does have some problems. The main one is root knot nematodes. It's like any, you know, when we set them in the field, of course we use the sterile media. You know, you need to use the Canadian artificial type media. You know, the Canadian peat moss. Don't use, you know, if you're going to grow transplants, which I recommend for homeowners because you get a head start on everything by setting a transplant in your bed as opposed to trying to go from seed. You know, everything is always moving in nature, and that means your pests and weeds and everything. So if you can get a head start by using a transplant, which is why we do it, and grow a nice transplant, but you have to start out clean, almost like a hospital operating room, to avoid the seedling diseases and get a good, healthy, you know, start with your operation. And so don't, you know, I've found out, you know, that you got to use the Canadian peat moss. It's mined in deep bogs in Canada, and it's inherently sterile. If you get local sources of potting media and growing media, it's usually, you know, contaminated right from the beginning. And so anyway, it's, and then the nematodes, you have to do something. And of course, there's different ways to mitigate it, and it's usually a combination of things that you do to try to, you know, make a crop. With the fact that our soils are nematode problems are endemic, especially root knot, and so you have to you know, using a transplant is in fact one way to one factor by getting a head start, getting the plant growing before, you know, the root knot,
Carl,
the nematodes invade the root system.
What is a nematode?
It's a microscopic worm. It's shaped like a worm. There's a whole kingdom called Nematoda. I mean, they inhabit every niche in our environment. They're even in our bodies. I understand there's diseases, human diseases caused by nematodes.
And what's the danger when you have a nematode infestation on your plants? Tell us what happens.
Well, it basically debilitates the root function. You, over time, as the in the case of root knot, there's different endo and ectoparasitic nematodes. In other words, some just cause the damage by feeding on the root tips in the soil, and some actually invade the root, which the root knot species does, and the females feed within the tissues of the root. They cause the swelling, and this causes a dysfunction of the root system. So what you end up with is gradually, like in the afternoons, your plants start to wilt, and you check the soil moisture. There's plenty of soil moisture there, and what it is the progression of the disease in the root system is gradually debilitating that root system so that it can't keep up with the transpiration the movement of moisture out the leaves, especially in the afternoon when the demand is high, so it's a debilitating thing. And you can do things culturally to mitigate it by, providing, keeping your soil moisture up, providing good nutrition. Or again, there are natural organisms in the soil which attack nematodes and help. And it's usually associated with it is associated with your organic matter, bacteria, fungi, and other, endemic microorganisms that can help to ameliorate it. And you can, one thing we do is we follow our spinach and chard behind collards and mustards and even Thai eggplant. We grow the Thai eggplant in the summertime, and those vegetables actually reduce the nematodes in the soil. And you can grow a nice, if you follow, behind those crops, you can. That's another kind of tactic in your bag of tools to try to combat this problem.
So, when you see a plant wilting and it's got plenty of water, that could be a sign you've got nematodes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right. So, and then, I'm sure some people spray chemicals on their crops in order to get rid of the nematodes, right?
Correct. Well, yes, there's different chemical controls, right? Uh-huh.
And so folks that want to grow organically, is there a product that they can go out and buy that would help reduce the impact of the nematodes?
There are. Maybe, I'm not an organic farmer myself, and maybe Debbie would have some ideas on, there are, I know that leftover products from shellfish, but like shrimp plants and stuff, they produce the shells and the chitinaceous material. And if you add those to the soil, it stimulates the organisms that eat chitin. And chitin is what is the integument of the nematode is based on chitin. And so if you build up those organisms in the soil that attack chitin as an energy source, those same microorganisms will begin to attack, things like nematodes. They could attack other species with those kinds of, outer body shells. So there are organic amendments. Organic amendments in general are going to mitigate. For one thing, they provide a better environment for the root system. The nutrient holding capacity, water holding capacity is greatly improved by just a 2% increase in organic matter. So that in itself will help the plant tolerate, you know, more, you know, of the nematode effects. But they also have their own direct effect. Some of the, you know, organisms, as I say, have a direct effect on the nematode's ability to, you know, thrive and reproduce itself in the soil. And a lot of cover crops and different plants growing in the soil. You can use companion crops. For instance, I think marigolds and things like that, if you plant them in combination with your vegetables, they'll help, you know, their root systems exude chemicals that again, you know, either stop the nematodes from feeding or reproducing, or maybe even actually kill the thing. So,
Carl, we should have changed the show all about nematodes. Yeah. There's so much, and of course they are a big problem. They certainly are, and it's kind of a lot of problems that folks that have never grown stuff really, you know, that, like you say, we don't know what's going on in the ground until a lot of times you really don't know until the end when you actually pull a plant out of the ground, right? And you see the root galls on there. And you go, oh, well, now I see what was wrong there. Well, you know, maybe we ought to talk a little bit about the different types. Like, Debbie, what are some of the collard types that you find are, you know, popular? You know, we sell at farmers markets, but and then the Swiss chard, some of the mustards maybe that Carl are growing now. Could you talk about the different varieties and some of that are a little more popular and hardy?
I don't know how popular they are because they're kind of newer to the general market, but we've been growing some heirloom collards that do very well for the last couple of years, and one of them's called Alabama Blue, and it comes from a very small family in Alabama, and it was saved by the Seed Saver people. And then there's one called Florida Variegated that I assume comes from a small family in North Florida. They both do wonderful in our climate here, and we've been growing those for a few years. And recently, apparently, we've been having trouble with the Florida broadleaf mustards, like wilting down and just dying out. And I didn't realize that was a widespread problem in Florida. So now they recommend planting Carolina broadleaf. And so we got some of that seed to try along with our other seed. And that might work well. We're not growing chard this year, but Carl already mentioned that. The real popular one is the colored one, the bright lights. But actually, I think the tastier one is the green chard.
Mm-hmm. And where would people find these varieties?
Well, there's a plethora of seed companies out there. And you know, we use Johnny's a lot. And there's High Mowing that a lot of people like. And most of these seed companies are up north. But if they're very responsive to southern growers, and they want our input on how well the things do and stuff like that, too.
And we're kind of doing this transition to our spring gardens here, and what are some of the stuff that we're going to go ahead and actually, we do have some tomatoes in trays. And Carl, do you have eggplants started already?
Yeah. I mean, this is almost the middle of February, so you can pretty much consider we're at least it's supposedly you know, when you reach February 15th that you can fairly safely feel that we're past any, you know, frost situation. So I mean we'll continue to have cool spells and cold fronts, but yeah, now's the time to get started. You know, if you haven't got your transplant started yet, I mean, we do have our eggplant. It should be ready to plant here in the next week or so. And so we want to, you know, be right and get them going, because as you move into the, you know, the hot season and everything speeds up when it gets hot in nature, and things happen very quickly. So you'd rather grow, you know, when things aren't moving quite so fast, and then beat the main pest pressures that occur in the summertime.
And, you know, like we have some potatoes, and maybe talk about potatoes, maybe some of the potato varieties of people like the Irish, would they be called, considered Irish potatoes or white potatoes? Debbie, maybe?
Well, yeah, usually around February, the middle of February is your planting time for potatoes, which they're totally different from sweet potatoes. Sweet potatoes are in the morning glory family, and potatoes are in the nightshade family. So we plant them at different times. And we've had a lot of luck with some of your standard varieties, especially I like to grow the red skin ones because they tend not to get the greening on them on the outside so easily. So we've used Red Pontiac, I believe, and Red Lasota, and then there's some good white-skinned ones as well. I think some people are growing Yukon and some of the others, and then there's the fancy ones too, but we have to grow something we can grow in a little more quantity for the market and still have some good variety. So that's what we plant. That's when we plant that sweet potatoes. Anytime we've got runners out there, we would plant those. They got hit pretty hard by the frost this year, so it's going to be a while before we can plant sweet potatoes again, but we're still selling them. And we're still, it's hot a lot quicker this year, so we're still seeding carrots and beets because you never know what's going to happen. But we're also planning on doing our getting our cucumbers in and just take a chance that they don't get hit too quick because they're fast, that they grow pretty fast. Now, things that take a long time, like your eggplant and your tomatoes, you should seed those probably in trays in January, because once it gets hot, those tomatoes aren't going to like it very much.
and real quick, Debbie, maybe how do we plant our white potatoes? Like, it's different than planting a sweet potato, right? You plant.
Yeah, usually cut them up in fairly good-sized chunks, but each chunk has to have a little eye on it, eye of the potato. And sometimes they're kind of hard to see because they shouldn't be all sprouted already, but sometimes they are. And then they, after you cut them, they should dry out a little bit. I wouldn't put them in wet right in the soil, but we'll do that and we'll plant them. How far apart, John?
Well, we're planting. Our row spacings aren't really super compatible to what the standard planting is, but they're about a foot apart. And we plant it would be six
staggered
inches.
Rows.
Yeah, we stagger the rows, and of course our rows are almost, they're a little more than 4 feet apart, so you have two close rows and a 4 foot spacing. Carl, maybe with your eggplant, and maybe we could talk about one thing about that I noticed that really kind of affects the potatoes we plant, or the blights. Could you talk a little bit about maybe some problems that if the people out there listening want to plant some tomatoes, something that they might want to watch out for?
Of course, tomatoes and potatoes.
I'm sorry, I said tomatoes. I meant potatoes.
Okay.
Oh, well.
Right. Well, like Deb says, your seed piece, you should cure it so that what it'll do, it'll callus over the cut area, and it cures best, in kind of around 80 degrees and a moist, not wet, but high humid type situation. And once it's calloused over, that'll help protect it once you plant it. And, of course, have your soil in good condition. In other words, you want to work it up well in advance so all the, plant residue is well broken down. This is a key element of disease control and getting a good stand of your crop, of any crop, but you know, it applies, of course, to potatoes. You know, this time of the year when it's cool and we get some foggy mornings, the main disease actually of both tomatoes and potatoes is the late blight, and it's you know, it's a particular kind of fungus that develops very rapidly. Of course, just the name of it, late blight, it implies that it can destroy, you know, all the above ground, you know, portions of the plant, and it can move very quickly. And so, you know, you want to, like all fungal disease, well, fungal and bacterial disease, you need to prune. Use pruning methods that keep air moving through the canopy. The longer the wet period, you know, a spore needs freestanding water to germinate. It produces a germ tube, and then it adheres to the surface and has a particular structure that it pierces through the cuticle and it enters and you know, starts infection. And that whole process takes about, you know, it depends on the temperature, you know, it could happen in 8 to 10 hours, 12 hours. So if you have wet periods that extend that long, this is something that's a major, you know, conducive factor. And a lot of farmers, you know, check these kinds of conditions to know when to spray, to apply their sprays. You know, the humidity and temperature situations, you know, can trigger. You better get out there and get some kind of protectant on the surfaces of your foliage and stems, and you can spray organic, you know, you copper, any kind of copper. They have these products like the Serenade. I forget what the name of the organism that's based on, but it stimulates the plant's own defenses, which is, it's a good product, but those kind of, and there's, it's a systemic effect across the whole plant, so that's another good thing too. But you, for those products, you gotta start applying them early, because the, you know, it takes a time for the plant machinery to begin to produce the chemicals that are triggered, you know, by these different microorganisms, different chemicals trigger these processes within the plant that produce, you know, they're chemicals within the plant that help the plant to fend off, you know, diseases and insects for that matter, they've found. So you'd want to apply those products right from the beginning. But really, if the conditions are conducive, like I say, you're getting some foggy mornings, you better be trying to, you know, protect, you know, get something on the foliage, try to keep the, you know, the plants pruned so that you get good aeration, you know, ventilation through the canopy and things like that.
Cool. Well, you know, and I just, we were talking about collard varieties. Maybe we could, Debbie, maybe, I know it's a little late, but maybe we could talk a little bit about tomato varieties. I know tomatoes are pretty hard to grow in Florida, believe it or not. And it's so funny when people from up north come to the farm, they want to see the big, nice tomatoes that they can grow up north. And I'm going, well, you know, we do have a little problem with that here in Florida. But could you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, I gave up on large tomatoes a long time ago until I discovered two seeds in a pod, and he's locally growing, Mehmet. He is locally growing lots of different heirloom seeds. He's dedicated to the heirloom seeds, and I never was until I started growing some of his varieties, mostly tomatoes, but now we're hoping to branch out to other things. But we've discovered some of the tastiest tomatoes ever, and now we're trying 8 additional varieties this year of tomatoes. And actually, we're hoping for a dry spring for a long time so that we can get those. We're trying a very rare pumpkin as well that looks like a giant squash or something like that. But right now I'm just growing that one for seed. But that's important, too, because some of these seeds come from southern Turkey, which has a similar climate. So they're working out great, and they taste every bit as good as anything from the Carolinas or Tennessee or someplace like that.
I was just kind of curious, too. You mentioned squash. What are some of the squash varieties you feel do fairly well in our area here?
Not many. Calabasa, which is actually, more like a winter squash pumpkin, has always done real good for us. We've usually saved the seed over time for that one. And it actually, even though it's a winter squash, it grows in the warmer times of the year usually. And if you can't save the seed or get some saved seed, there is a variety called La Estrella, and it's available at one of the seed companies up north. But I think if you trade around seeds, you can find a few or buy one in the market and save the seed on those.
They could contact us. We always have extra.
We usually
seeds.
Have seed, and but I'm not having really good luck with a lot of the summer squashes. There was one called I believe it's Alexandria.
Yeah,
and now Johnny's has quit carrying the seed. I still have some, but I think some other companies have it. And I think it's considered a Mideastern one, but it looks like a large, pale
zucchini,
and it's delicious. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do that one again. I've tried some other ones, but maybe not in enough quantity and not had much luck with patty pans, really. I mean, they just take up so much space and don't produce enough. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going back to those right now.
And Carl, you grow eggplant, but you kind of grow a specialty eggplant. Would you have any suggestions, like for an easy to grow eggplant? Like a lot of people, they might want to just put one in a pot and put it on their back porch. And I've heard people and say, "Well, yeah, I can go out there and get a couple of eggplant." Any suggestions on eggplant varieties?
Well, you mentioned growing in pots. That's a good idea for things like tomato. Like tomatoes, peppers. We got in our back patio jalapeno that must be 4 years old that keeps producing peppers. So that's a way to avoid the nematode question because they. Nematodes have such a wide host range. They pretty much anything, with some exceptions I mentioned, like collards and mustards, the Thai. The smaller the fruit, generally, the more the species can tolerate it. They generally have more disease resistance. That's why Debbie says that the small, like grape tomatoes and cherry tomatoes, are easier for us to grow than the large fruited varieties. Maybe it's because of the energy the plant expends. I don't know. The cherries and the grapes are very prolific, and they produce a lot of fruit. But generally, just in general, they're more resistant to nematodes, disease, and insects, for that matter. And actually, on the eggplant, eggplants, just like all these, species that man has taken as their, one of their staples. Our whole food supply is dependent on very few, actually, species that have been bred and different varieties. And just like all the different squashes and all the different peppers and potatoes, all of them have been, distributed around the world and grown and eaten. And eggplant's no different. All the nightshades pretty much originated in South America, Central America region, up in the mountains, and the Aztec and Mayan civilizations, propagated these same types of vegetables. But again, on the eggplant, if the Thai eggplant is a very tough tolerant. It's much more easier for me to produce the Thai, which is a small, round, white and green striped eggplant. It is the fruit are about the size of a golf ball, and but it resists the nematodes. It's just a generally easier. I mean, it gets some of the same diseases and insect problems as the others. But if you want a really hardy one, it's the eating quality is it's a little tougher. I grow the Chinese too. Chinese I like as far as the eating quality the best. It's a long purple fruited variety, and you can grow all these, and I grow the Indian eggplant too, which is a small round purple fruited type. But if you can get some Thai eggplant seed, you should try it. I mean, it'll produce a lot of eggplant. You can, and it's fun to think about different ways of how to cook it and eat it. But the Chinese too. That's the most. The Chinese has a bigger, much bigger market, and it's eaten in more countries. The Thai is not so widely, used. Obviously in Thailand, but the Chinese eggplant, the Philippines, China, of course, the Middle East, they all have varieties of the Chinese that's common in their markets. So that's a very popular, Asian type.
Debbie kind of put a note there in front of him, and maybe we should talk about determinate and indeterminate and heirloom plants. Debbie, maybe you had a little comment about the tomatoes.
Well, all of those wonderful tomatoes are almost all indeterminate, which means they're going to grow and produce most of the season, but they're going to get gigantic. And I can't imagine keeping one of those in a container. But there are some other varieties. One of them that we're trying is determinate. They'll produce more of the stuff all at once, apparently, but they'll stay a little bit smaller. And I'm sure there are non-heirlooms mainly that would be developed for container growth. I know Extension used to have container tomato suggestions years ago, but I'm pretty old now, so they may not have that anymore. So,
well, you're listening to the Sustainable Living Program today, and it's a family affair because John Butts is here with his wife, Debbie Butts, and his brother, Carl Butts, and they're talking about gardening and how to start your garden. This is a good time to do it for some vegetables, as you've heard. We want to thank Karen Elizabeth in Plant City with the Plant City Commons Community Garden for making a $100 contribution
thank
online.
Thank you, Karen.
And Suzanne made a $25 contribution online. Thank you, Suzanne, yes. And like Sustainable Living and Alternative Health. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. So if you've got a question for John, I guess our phones are not working. So you're going to have to send in your email question to dj@wmnf.org. Here's the address again. It's dj@wmnf.org. Frank Knox is trying to get the phones to work, but let's see. Maybe we've got a caller here. Caller, you're on the air with John and Debbie and Carl. What's your question?
Oh, hey, guys. I had pretty good luck with cherry tomatoes, but with large tomatoes, I always get these spots on them. And it happened at my old house, and I moved up the road, and it happened at my new house. What is causing that?
What kind of spots, caller?
They are like, they're discolorations in the tomato. Like, I don't know how to explain it. They're just spotted. And it doesn't happen to the cherry tomatoes. It only happens to the big tomatoes, and I never can get a big tomato fully grown. They either get eaten by something before they're done, or they get them dang spots.
It's difficult. We have to trap critters at our place, and there's a lot of diseases and insects, and it's not easy growing tomatoes. But and if you're talking about like hard spots or yellow spots,
yes.
It might be stink bug damage. The stink bugs love tomatoes, and boy, are they hard to control. They actually do a tiny puncture almost microscopic on a tomato and some other crops too, but and it causes, I guess they secrete something as well, and it causes these terrible spots. So they just ruin them. I mean, I have the trouble with some of my cherry tomatoes when there's a lot of pressure on it. And so they are very difficult to control, and then they carry disease too, and they then that starts up again too.
Carl, any?
I bought some of that soil last year you guys talked about. I spent a good buck on that soil. I think it was like $400 or something. I had it delivered down to my house here in Bradenton, and I'm going to have my soil tested this year because I think I'm more acidic because I have a lot of manure in there. But I think I'm going to grow all sweet corn this year, and I had some last year, but I didn't have a high yield. So I'm hoping that if I get my soil straight and I'm using some, you know, maybe some fertilizer or something, I can get a lot of corn this year because I'm going to plant all corn.
Yeah. If you don't have critters. Also, corn's a real heavy feeder. It really likes a lot of nitrogen, so that might be a good choice. And as long as you plant it in a big block because it's wind-pollinated, so you get good
Carl, any comments on the tomato problem?
Well, I agree with Debbie's analysis of that. Right, stink bugs. Once they pierce the tissue, they disrupt the normal ripening process in that particular area. They secrete something in there that, so you end up with a hard, you know, and like I say, it doesn't ripen properly. You get these spots, and stink bugs are very common. There's a, you know, green stink bugs and the, you know, brown plant bugs. They're all, you know, have these piercing, sucking mouth parts, and they all love, you know, these, you know, all kinds of vegetables. They you know, they'll get into the eggplant. Not too bad of a problem in the eggplant, but
I was going to start all my corn. You know, last year I put it right in the ground. Quite a bit of it come up, but this year I was going to maybe start all of them in Jiffy pods. Do you think I'm wasting my time, or put all my corn in Jiffy pods and start them that way?
Either that or small cell trays. Yeah, we've been doing that lately too.
Yeah, we've been doing that because, for one thing, you know, sweet corn costs a lot of money. You know, it's a heavy seed, and we have these real, like, I don't know, what are they, Carl? There's about 150 holes in these trays.
I got one.
And they, once they germinate, you know, then you're good to go to stick them out there. But, you know, truthfully, I've about given up on corn. I mean, I would rather try to, you know, perfect my tomato growing. The corn, every year it just seems like there's something. I mean, the worms like them, the beetles like them, the ants like them, the raccoons like them, and it's just terrible. I mean, I've tried, and I used to be pretty good at it, you know, and it gets worse. But the only, you know, my suggestion for the tomatoes is netting, is to find some kind of crop netting that's lightweight that you can throw over your tomatoes, and then that's about the only way that I know to control the darn stink bugs. But it works. But, you know, it's a little extra labor. But if you know, you'll only have to go in there every couple of days to throw the netting out. Carl, any suggestions?
What kind of netting are we talking about? Like, it's got to be super fine.
Oh yeah, there's vegetable netting. You can get them like any of the kind of the you know, the little companies that sell that kind of stuff, that there are you know, netting. And of course, people that grow in greenhouses where they have screen doors, they have a lot better luck with the tomatoes because of the stink bugs.
Right. I've even had them spots in grow boxes too on my tomatoes. Mm-hmm.
Have you tried taking samples into your local extension service?
No, but I'm gonna this year.
I wasn't
money on corn and not you know, get a yield this year.
Because it may be something else. Who knows? You know, and if they get, if you can actually look at it, that really helps troubleshooting.
Okay. Well, all right. I should get them in pretty soon, shouldn't I?
Yeah.
Your tomatoes?
No, the corn.
Oh well, you know, it's about right now. It's right the time to start. I mean, you wouldn't want to start before now. That's for sure.
Right, I'm going to roll the till and get it ready and have my soil tested and then get my seeds started here in the next week or so. So I hope I get them in the ground soon. But okay. Thank you for all the information. I appreciate you guys, and I appreciate the station. And I love listening to you guys especially. So thank you.
Well, all thanks. Right, caller. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. Now, JD in Tampa writes, I heard John's brother talking about the sterility of soil being super important, and I bought some organic soil. It has snails in it. Now, everything in my garden has so many snails, I can't get anything new to grow. They eat it all up as soon as the sprouts come out, and they love and live in my bromeliads especially. Any ideas on how to eradicate snails?
Don't they have baits? I have problems with slugs. I mean, which are kind of in the same group of animals that they'll eat the seedlings. Especially if you set something out early that's tender. You better. I mean, since I'm a conventional farmer, as soon as I set my transplants, I go over them with my backpack and. I put a little starter fertilizer in there, but there's an insecticide to kill the slugs, and of course there could be mole crickets, there could be cutworms. I mean, if you don't have a good stand, you're from the get go, you're fighting an uphill battle from then on. So you gotta, it used to be, I guess, in home gardens, people put little paper collars around their tomatoes to keep the dang cutworms and insects from eating them. But I think there are some baits which would be, to target the snails. It wouldn't be something that would, be affecting your beneficial organisms in the garden area. But I'm not... like I say, I'm a conventional farmer, but of course, when I was talking about sterile soil, I was talking about your media to grow the transplants. Of course, when they go into the garden, they're going to go into not a hostile environment, but if you have your soil well prepared you've gone through that first stage of breaking down of the previous crop residues and vegetative matter, then it's as in good a shape as you can get it. But you'll have a mixture of beneficial and pathogenic organisms, and hopefully the beneficials will crowd out and that's that's part of your preparation to plant of the soil.
Yeah, that you put that transplant in, and you forget about it, and you go back the next day, and they're chewed off, and it's really frustrating sometimes. And I can do the same thing, and there are a lot of things like neem, pesticides that you can, and that's, used to use some mole cricket bait like Carl, but it wasn't organic. So now I just kind of mix up some neem, and I spray it around, maybe every other day, at least for a couple of weeks, I'm worried about those transplants. But like you say, the cutworms, they're really aggravating because they actually live in the ground and you don't see them. And like after the plant's cut down, you're going, well, was it rabbits? What was it? And if you start kind of looking around in the soil and you look and you'll find this big brown worm, and you go, oh God, well, there's the problem. And as I say, most worms, we use BTs on them, but they are kind of hard to do. And of course, the mole crickets, there's a lot of damage that can be caused by those transplants with the by the mole crickets. And Carl, you actually use plastic mulch, right?
Yeah, but I use it over several years. Matter of fact, I tried to get some photos set, our picking operation today, but that plastic we're using to grow the spinach on currently over at this other little field, it's 3 years old. So,
wow.
So over time, the things like slugs and other things start to grow underneath the plastic, and of course the plastic has a lot of holes from the previous crops. And mole crickets are in there, of course, feeding on residue and so on. So it's the kind of the same thing as mulch. You know, all these critters, they like a nice cover of mulch, and when you plant a nice little fresh green sprig out there, they gravitate toward it. So you do have to have some kind of game plan.
Uh-huh. Carl, you know, we're kind of running out of time here, but another thing that I wanted to touch in, and I see a lot of, you know, I kind of look at the Tampa Garden Swap Facebook page, and a lot of people, you know, they'll talk about they have something like an eggplant or a tomato that has a bloom on there, and they'll go out and the bloom's gone. Like they're kind of separated right at the stem, and the bloom, say like peppers, what would you say that problem would be?
Well, you know, there's hormones and biological processes that tell the plant whether to grow vegetatively or to go to fruiting and flowering, you know, a reproductive type phase of growth. And lots of times in the transition, going from, you know, rapid vegetative growth, which occurs early in the crop cycle, you know, you have hormone, you know, things that are preventing flowering.
Mm-hmm.
So if you push and high nitrogen situations do favor vegetative over reproductive growth. So sometimes it could be that. Sometimes it could be too much shade. You know, shade. It's a carbon nitrogen ratio within the plant type situation, and you want to favor reproductive type growth. You want a higher carbon component of the ratio rather than nitrogen. In other words, more sugars and carbohydrates flowing around in the plant than proteins and amino acids. So you know, there's different environmental cues as well as fertility and lighting conditions that can cause, you know, flowers to abort because the plant is still favoring the vegetative phase of its growth cycle. And until you kind of make adjustments to adjust that carbon-nitrogen ratio, which would involve, if it's too much nitrogen, you know, cut back on your supplements or your fertilizer, or move them to get them in a sunnier location if they're in a pot or things like that.
Okay. Maybe we should talk about where the listeners might be able to find information or help if they have a gardening problem run my mouth here just for a second. I think being part of a community garden is a good place to get help with, if you're a first-time gardener, that there's always a lot of help in these community gardens. They seem to kind of pull their resources together and help the new people in there. But go ahead, Debbie, maybe some suggestions where people might find help, like with the extension services or any suggestions, books?
Well, you've got to be careful with the books. They should be Florida-based. Otherwise, it's going to be opposite timing and everything. So the extension service, which you don't have to go in, there's a lot of information online from EDIS. The electronic system that they have has a lot of publications and information and photos and everything as well. But almost every county has an extension service that has knowledgeable volunteers and other people and agents.
Carl, any suggestions?
Well, I think those two are really good. You know, if you're in a community garden and there's all sorts of sources online, and like Debbie says, you want the University of Florida to get the information which is applicable, you know, to growing in our state. So that's, you know, that's the primary source, I think. But you learn a lot going out and talking to other people and sharing experiences and listening to shows like this, I guess.
Farmers markets as well. I mean, we talk all the time to customers, and we give them information. They give us information. They have heirlooms and things, so you never know.
John and Debbie and Carl, Andy writes, to control snails in your vegetable garden, put small dishes of beer around the perimeter, and the snails climb in, and they don't come back out.
I've heard that one. That's an old remedy there.
Yeah, there you go. Cool. All right. So some beer dishes around your garden. Well, we're down to the last 40 seconds of the show, and you're listening to the Sustainable Living Program on WMNF in Tampa with Carl Butts, Debbie Butts, and John Butts. And for a while there, we had CJ, John's grandson, was in here too.
Well, thank you all very much, and thank you, Rob. And hey, support WMNF. We're depending on you.
Yeah, the marathon was delayed because our phone system crashed and burned last Friday morning, and we're replacing the phone system, at least a big part of it, right now, and we hope to restart our fund drive today at 2 o'clock. So, John, we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Yep. Well, you'll see me next week. Well, hopefully. I don't know. We'll see.
Okay. This is...